Bill for our consideration is Senate File Number 84. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 84, introduced by Senator Hastert, an act relating to crimes and offenses, aggravated assault, choking. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bagby, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 84 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. I'll explain the amendment real quick. It actually doesn't change anything other than, if you look on page 2, lines 15 through 21, what we were trying to do in committee was make the structure, so we haven't changed the wording, we just want the structure to look like in Romanet 5, we want it to look just like Romanet 1. So we want to start with, instead of starting with intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, we want to start with causes or attempts to cause, and so it would flow consistently on down the line. So that's what the Standing Committee Amendment was doing, was just rearranging the language so 5 would be consistent with Romanet 1. And unless there's any questions, I would ask for an aye vote on the Standing Committee Amendment.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. What this does is just a cleanup that the attorneys pointed out to me. On page 1, line 5, it was stating that in the bill somewhere we would be providing definitions. Actually, on the Senate side, they took out the definitions, and we agreed with that. So there was no need for that little clause there on line 5 that says providing definitions. So all this does is delete the two words providing definitions. And I'd ask for your aye vote.
Representative Throne? No? We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. All those in favor of the Committee of the Whole Amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for an explanation of the bill, I would turn over the bill explanation to the representative from Laramie County.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today, we bring you Senate File 84 to close a gap in our laws related to battery and aggravated battery. Our aggravated battery statute has been a problem for our Supreme Court in a number of different cases, but most recently in a case that came down just in January of this year. And let me, without getting too graphic, briefly describe the facts of this case to you. And in this case, the defendant was originally convicted of aggravated battery, but on appeal to the Supreme Court concluded that this set of facts that I'm about to describe to you was just battery, not aggravated battery. During the late night and early morning hours of May 11th through 12th, 2007, the defendant attacked and beat the victim because he suspected her of cheating on him. He repeatedly punched her in the face and head. The beating continued over a period of an hour and a half. He threatened to kill her. He kicked her in the head and face and tried to stuff both his hands, fingers extended, down her throat. The victim was unable to breathe or scream during that time. She fell in and out of consciousness during the beating. When she was able to, she screamed as loud as she could and banged on the door in order to summon help. A neighbor heard her cries and called the police. Many photos were taken. They graphically depict the injuries that she described in her testimony. She had a wound that required 20 stitches to close. She could not swallow food for 5 days because her throat was so sore from the assault. Her throat was swollen and infected. She also suffered a non-displaced fracture to her right sinus, and her right cheekbone was cracked. Her eyes were blackened and bloodied, and one was swollen almost shut. She had bruises all over her head, neck, and ears. But based on that set of facts, because of our definition of aggravated battery in our statutes, which requires serious bodily injury, which includes loss of vital organ function or permanent disfigurement, the Supreme Court felt compelled to overturn the conviction on aggravated battery and to reduce the charges to just simple battery. And this is a quote from the Supreme Court case. "We hasten to add that the defendant's conduct was despicable, reprehensible, and brutal. But what the law has recognized as battery and what it has recognized as aggravated battery is separated by a considerable chasm which the legislature may want to address." So that is the purpose of the bill, to address the definition of aggravated battery, which really allows a pretty severe beating to be reduced to regular battery. And turning to the bill, the approach to address the Supreme Court's concern is really pretty straightforward. The bill states that anytime you cause, and then this is the additional language, or attempt to cause serious bodily injury to another. So we've added attempts to cause, so that basically we're not rewarding somebody for not getting the job done. If they beat somebody so badly that they cause fractures but it doesn't lead to permanent disfigurement, then they've attempted to cause serious bodily injury. And then the bill also adds a new Romanet 5 to deal specifically with the issue of choking, because choking is obviously, in the context of a fight and with reckless disregard for human life, choking can kill somebody. But when it's all said and done, there may not be visible injuries on the neck or anything that would approach permanent disfigurement to qualify as aggravated battery. So there are really just two parts to the bill. One is to insert attempts to cause, so again, we don't reward somebody for not actually getting the job done, and then also to specifically reference choking, which is not clearly covered by the current definition of aggravated battery. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is very simple, and I understand the need for this bill. I just wanted you to illustrate what this would encompass. My very good friend, our page from Cody, has come down, and he likes to, like me, practice mixed martial arts, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and Muay Thai. You'll notice he had a broken nose and a minor concussion and some black eyes and some bruises because golf is not a sport, because you wear funny clothes and there's no contact. So for those of us who enjoy real athletic endeavors, like fight class, I want to make sure that on Tuesday and Thursday night, when I am there with the page and he applies pressure to my throat and neck by blocking, applying pressure and suffocating, is that free and clear, whereas this cannot be charged?
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's important to recognize that there are four elements to aggravated battery as proposed, and they include causes or attempts to cause serious bodily injury to another intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. If two parties are engaged in consensual martial arts, following rules Well, competitive. I don't know the right terminology. Whatever. Engaged in the sport of martial arts. They're following rules. It's obviously not reckless conduct. Does not rise to extreme indifference to the value of human life. And so this, I think there's really not any question that there would be inadvertent, charging of aggravated battery for participants in martial arts.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I really have, I guess question and comment, as I read through Section 5, it seems to be simply an additional category of what would be included under Section I, little I up top. I mean, if we are talking about causing or attempting to cause bodily injury, certainly choking would fall under that. And, I mean, we haven't broken out every imaginable way that you can do that. But I guess my question is, I certainly see the need of including the or attempts to cause under little I. But why do we need Section 5? Aren't we actually sort of drawing some boundaries on the bill that we don't need to?
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the good representative from Natrona County for his question. We had this discussion in committee, and some of us have continued to have the discussion about whether Romanet 5 is necessary. Romanet 5 is necessary and recommended from many of our prosecutors because choking, as I mentioned in my introductory remarks, does present sort of a unique circumstance where it's obviously very life-threatening, but the physical evidence of it is not always evident. And for purposes of actually prosecuting and having a clear basis to prosecute choking, when it really is intended as a violent attack, the prosecutors would prefer to leave Romanet 5 in place as proposed.
Is there any other discussion? Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. When I read in the Standing Committee Amendment to page 2, line 15, it seems to leave in the words intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, and it doesn't look like that was the intent of the amendment. It looks like it's Romanet 5 is now supposed to read causes or attempts to cause serious bodily injury to another by impeding or to another under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life by impeding the normal breathing or circulation, etc. Am I reading that wrong?
Chairman Gingrey.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, what we were trying to do was, if you look in Romanet 1, we actually wanted to read identical to Romanet 1, except for at the end of it, you add in, by impeding the normal breathing or circulation of blood to another person, that clause. So we do want to leave intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, which clearly raises the point that the good gentleman from Casper already raised. Do you really need Romanet 5 if you have Romanet 1? This certainly has been debated back and forth because if they're worded identical, which they are now with the exception of that extra clause at the end of Romanet 5 about the impeding normal breathing or circulation, you may not actually need 5. There was some testimony from the prosecutors that they wanted Romanet 5 primarily for jury instruction benefit, which I didn't really buy into that much, but it doesn't hurt anything by leaving it in, but if someone on second reading wants to take out 5, that's fine, I think, because really you're accomplishing what they were setting out to do by simply just inserting the words or attempts to cause in Romanet 1. Because, again, here's what the problem is. Serious bodily injury is such a tough definition in the statutes. You actually have to show disfigurement, a permanent disfigurement. So what happens is, so if you choke somebody and really damage them, and it and it heals, though, that's not serious bodily injury. And so you were unable to get convictions on a choking. Same thing with if you punch somebody really hard and you break their jaw, but because the doctor's able to fix the jaw, they can't get you for the more serious because you don't have permanent serious disfigurement. And so that's why the attempts to cause fixes that problem. Maybe that was more information than I was actually asked.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
I have a question about the words intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly in this statute in Romanet 1 and 5, but the causes or attempts to cause serious bodily injury to another, why do you need intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly when any one of those has to be under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life? If I accidentally cause serious bodily injury to another under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference, then I could be charged with aggravated assault. But it was not intentional. It wasn't knowingly and it wasn't reckless. Could I still be charged if it was an accident?
Chairman Gingrey.
Mr. Chairman, he raises a good point. We talked about this in committee. The difficulty is that, because you really probably don't need this under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, and we actually talked about taking that out. The difficulty is that in other places in the statute, we've used this same combination of words. And the testimony from at least one of the prosecutors was that we needed to stick with the same exact wording and not mess with it because, number one, case law has been interpreting these phrases, and also the jury instructions are keyed to these exact words. But logically, I think the speaker is correct. You could delete out the extreme indifference clause and just go with intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. Or actually, you could go the other direction too. Delete intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, and just do the extreme difference. But the point that was made was, because I think we all agreed in committee that these words, there might be better ways of always wording a statute better, but because the case law and because the jury instructions are keyed to this, we were cautioned not to mess with the structure too much.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. Those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 84 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File Number 84 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File Number 37. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 37, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to standards for antifreeze and petroleum products. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Muniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace, Swanitzer, Dan, Blake, excused. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman. The bill was further referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp, no, Stewart, signed representing Berger, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Semlek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 37 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the standing committee amendment. And Mr. Chairman, the standing committee amendment has to do with the appropriation. And in the other body, the appropriations committee chose not to biennialize a $25,000 request in the appropriation for a contractual testing. They chose to leave the $25,000 in that section, and they chose to leave $180,600 in another section for the purchase of equipment, which I will explain to you at a later time. So the total of those two is total of those two amounts is a corrective summation of those two, and the Standing Committee amendment would reflect that the appropriation is $205,600. And, Mr. Chairman, I would ask, I would call for the question on the Standing Committee amendment.
Question having been called, all those in favor on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Semlick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Antifreeze and petroleum products has the oversight in our state government within the Department of Agriculture. And what this bill will do, beginning down on the bottom of page 1, it talks about the section 1 is amended to read. And what we see there is some changes in definition of products to reflect some current updates and some new products that are on the market. It also will further define some additional new products, particularly in the area of diesel fuel. We're seeing biodiesel fuel and those kind of products out there. So the changes in the first part of the bill really reflect some more modern language and some further definitions based on new products. I will ask you, if you're tracking the bill, to go over to page 8, kind of on the enforcement issue, and that's kind of probably a better explanation of what we're trying to do in this bill is possibly found in this section. And it's, you see some of the new language in there in 47105 under the enforcement, is that the director, referring here then to the Department of Ag director, he shall periodically collect samples of petroleum products, engine fuel from every storage tank. You can just kind of follow along there. Any storage tank or any dispensing facility or device that it's used to dispense petroleum products in the state of Wyoming shall be tested, and it goes on list kind of the details of how those samples shall take place and how they will take place. And this enforcement issue has kind of come up as a result of some of the higher gas and fuel prices that we'd seen over the last 6 months to a year, not including the last 3 or 4 months, however, where the consumer complaints have increased about 90%, and the department in the testimony of the committee said that about 60 of these complaints were validated, and it had to do with fuels being represented as such, that not what they were supposed to be, perhaps with octane, perhaps with some contamination problems. So this is an attempt through the scope of this bill to continue to upgrade the laboratory in the Department of Ag to continue to be able to sample these products, particularly from the perspective of consumer protection. There's about 1,700 samples based on testimony in the committee that need to be taken every year. And the testimony was that the call for complaints increased by about 2.5 times when the fuel prices increased. And again, about 60% of those were validated. The reason that we're come to you with this bill and the Department of Ag is that Wyoming is currently not where it should be in terms of its analytical service in being able to test these fuels. And it doesn't take too long for the wholesalers to recognize that. And the fear is that Wyoming will become kind of a dumping ground of inferior grades in contaminated gasoline and fuel products if we don't do the due diligence, as our surrounding states have done, to make sure that we have a good analyzing equipment and make sure that we're following the standards that are required to make sure that consumers, again, are purchasing a product that is being represented as being such. There was a couple good questions that came out of the Appropriations Committee in regard to this bill, and one of them had to do with with the labs that we currently have, or we are currently in the process of building some new labs. And there's the new state lab here in this community. It will house the health department, the DEQ, water and air quality, and then DCI crime laboratories. And the testimony was, I wasn't able to have that information available for the Appropriations Committee, but in a letter, a note that I got back from the director of our analytical service, who had been there for 25 years, says that, indicated that these labs will not be able to perform these functions. The analytical service of the Department of Ag is the only state of Wyoming laboratory with expertise in the area of antifreeze and fuel, so all the analytical work regarding these samples will be performed in this facility. Another good question come from one of the Appropriation Committee members in regard to a section in the bill here about, hopefully I can find it, about fuels being seized. That would be on page 9, seizure and sale. And the question was, well, what are we doing with these fuels that are being confiscated because they don't meet the standards? And the testimony was, again, coming from the director, was that in all the years that he had been there, some of the fuel had been was suspect, but none of it had ever been seized and sold. So if there's any fear that this is going to be a witch hunt going out there, going after our private sector fuel distributors, well, they will ask for them to conform to the regulations, but they're not going to be out there seizing their fuels. They work with these distributors who might have had some contamination in their fuel. They try to get the fuel cleaned up and get it marketed so there's really no loss to them. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the House, the appropriations, again, is a one-time expense of $180,600 to purchase equipment and instruments necessary for the analytical testing program. And then a lot of these samples are that we test, like the 1,700 different fuel devices that we have out there, they will be sent out for fee estimated about $25,000 a year for contractual testing of octane. So that is the bill, and I would stand for any questions.
Is there any other discussion of the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Semlich's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 37 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Senate File 37 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File Number 23. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 23, introduced by Senator Massey, an act relating to the Education Loan Repayment Program, Accelerated Nursing Degree Loan Repayment Program. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubno, McComey, Teeters, McKim. Signed, Arzane McComey, Chairman. The bill was further referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Phelps, Stewart. Signed, Representing Berger, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 23 do pass. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to turn the explanation of the bill over to the fine lady from House District 8 in Laramie County.
Representative Millen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman. About Senate File 23. With the demand for nurses increasing in all healthcare settings, such as our hospitals, home health, community care centers, schools, etc., by 103% in Wyoming through 2014, we feel the best means of dealing with these shortages is to grow our own. Wyoming has done this with the WIN, which stands for the Wyoming Investment in Nursing Program, but one of the best means of attracting and graduating nurses into the workforce is through an accelerated nursing program that results in a BSN degree. 43 states have these programs. The program at the University of Wyoming started in 2006 with class sizes of 20 students. This is for students who already have a bachelor's degree in something other than nursing. These students are usually motivated and have a demonstrated record of academic success and are more likely to remain in Wyoming due to the fact that they are usually more mature and settled in Wyoming. This is a 15-month intense nursing degree program, but does not cut corners on the clinic instruction. The tuition is approximately $23,000 for the 58 credit hours for that 15-month program. The intensity of the program prevents students from having a full-time job. Remember, we want the best students, but some students cannot afford tuition, and they have to stop working their current job for those 15 months, so that is why this legislation is necessary. So in getting to the bill itself, in Section 1 on Page 1, Statute 2117-121 is new language that we've added in. On page 2, it says that you have to have that bachelor's degree other than in nursing already and be approved by the UW president with advice from the State Board of Nursing to participate in this class. Statute 2117-105D gives preference for those who are residents of Wyoming. And then if you go to page 3, students can receive up to $25,000 from the program to support tuition and other costs related to the course. Students must work as a nurse in the state for 2 years or pay back the amount of state funds with interest. On page 4, it states that the Board of Trustees may waive the payback requirements if funds cannot be collected. A report on relieved students shall be sent to the Joint Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee annually. Loan repayment can be deferred up to 5 years for graduates who serve full-time in the active military. On page 5, funds repaid by former students shall be deposited into a special account maintained by the University of Wyoming and used to pay tuition costs for future students in the program. In Section 2, it just talks about the transfer of the $251,000. Just a reminder, this is not new appropriations. This is money that's already been appropriated from 2008. So, again, this is not new money. It's already there. The funds will cover 2 cohort classes that will start the fall semester of 2009 and the spring semester of 2010. There should be no more than 6 students in each of the class cohorts, and any surplus funds will revert. Future requests and appropriations will be included in UW's medical education budget, and if there are any questions on this bill, I stand for questions. And if there's no questions, then we, yep.
Mr. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. 6 students, it says in each class, and you use the word cohort. So is it 6 students per class, or is there more than one class in a cohort?
I believe it is 2 classes with 6 students in each class. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, thank you.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, maybe you explain this and I just didn't understand. On page 2, Romanet 2, it appears to in order to qualify, you need to already have a BA in something other than nursing. What if I'm just going to college and I just want to get a nursing degree? Is this not a program for that person, or do we already have a different program for those people? This only applies to people that already have a degree in, I don't know, engineering or something else, and now they want to become a nurse.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is another program for people who want a bachelor's or an AA in nursing. It's a wholly separate program. This is just an accelerated program for those persons who already have a degree and then want to go back. They joked in committee that it was the liberal arts full employment degree. These folks are really under high demand because they already have the degree. They've proven that they can work, and they're a little more mature than just a normal college student. So what they've found is that it's really, really a high-demand program. The problem is one of golden handcuffs, because people already have jobs, already have lives, and can't afford to take the 15 months off. You've got 58 credit hours in a 15-month period, so there's not a lot of time to fool around. You're busy working, studying to be a nurse. The other important thing about this program is it's an extension program. The University of Wyoming takes the nursing program to the communities, and so the clinical experiences are in all of the communities around the state of Wyoming and not just at Laramie and the university, so people can maintain a life where they are and still get a nursing degree out in the communities where we need people.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Are you all ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 23 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File Number 23 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File Number 127. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate Bill 127, introduced by Senator Ross, an act relating to junk dealers. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Semlek, Wallace. No, Miller, Peterson. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 127 do pass. We do have a Committee of the Whole, a Standing Committee Amendment, number one. I would move that at this time and explain it and ask for your vote on it. If you look at page one, the last line on that would read a metal beer keg that has capacity equal to or greater than 5 gallons or any recognizable part of such a beer keg. The reason for that amendment was that some of those smaller beer kegs are purchased with the product in them, and they're not property of the breweries. With that, I would ask for your vote on the Standing Committee Amendment.
You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Anderson.
Thank you for the explanation of the bill. I turn it over to Representative Gingrey.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this bill does, and I gave you a handout earlier today that describes the problem, as the price of scrap metal has gone up, more and more people are stealing beer kegs and taking them to scrap metal dealers and getting the money for them. The difficulty is that the keg is actually owned by the brewery itself, actually not by the distributor or by the liquor store. They're actually owned by the brewer. There was testimony that the one brew company that came to talk to the committee, they actually send all their kegs to a place in Wisconsin that cleans them out, and then they reuse them. And actually, a keg gets used for up to 20 years, just reused over and over for up to 20 years before it finally gets so dinged up they do scrap it. But they scrap it all through the same place. And so there's never any reason why any scrap metal yard in Wyoming would ever need to have a keg because at their place of business, because, well, unless they're drinking out of it, I guess. Because they all, when they get scrapped or when they get cleaned, they all go back to this same place in Wisconsin that has this business that they do this. So where do they steal it? Well, I thought maybe, because I was thinking, well, wait a minute, when you go to get a keg, usually you have to leave your driver's license and you leave a deposit or whatever. That's actually not where the theft's occurring primarily. The theft's occurring when people, the liquor store will set them out for the delivery truck to pick up, and somebody will come by and steal them, or the employees steal them, and multiple different ways they're getting stolen and getting taken to the scrapyard. And then there actually was some testimony that some people have figured out arbitrage, and so they put down their deposit and then realized the gain when you take it to the scrap metal shop. So the first question is, well, why don't you just go after the person who stole it? And you certainly can. You can go after the person who stole it. The difficulty is that they show up at the scrap metal shop, their scrap metal yard that primarily deals in cash. They drop it off. The cash is paid. The person leaves. Then the brewery company comes by, because there was testimony, the guy drives around and buys back his own kegs. And so he says, you know, our stamp's on there. That's our property. You shouldn't have taken that. And the scrap metal guy says, yeah, I probably shouldn't have. So what this is trying to do, even though you can still go after the guy that stole it, it's trying to take away the fence. If you take away the market for stolen property, the stealing hopefully dries up. So what this bill does is says that no junk dealer shall knowingly purchase or possess a keg or any pieces of a keg. That way, it actually makes the junk dealer's job easier. The junk dealer can just simply say to the person, listen, it's illegal for me to accept a beer keg. I can't take that from you. You're going to have to go away, or I guess they can call the cops, too. And so that's the concept of the bill. It just takes away the fencing ability of the crime. And then there was some cleanup over on page 2 on the penalties. There was this word, or either, which we don't normally use, and so that was taken out. I'm not sure how that got in the statute originally. And then if you look on the handout, it states there that the industry is losing up to $50 million annually, losing their kegs. The kegs are worth about $130 a piece. And so that was the concept of the bill, and I would stand for any questions.
Further discussion, Representatives Wanitz or Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm for sure not in favor of this bill. To me, it looks like we're having one industry police for another industry. But with that in mind, let me, I do have a couple of questions. I guess I have a statement first, but junk dealers are required to keep records of what everybody brings in. And it seems to me if in the records they should be able to track back to the persons that brought those kegs in and then use the appropriate action. But a couple of questions I do have is, number one, if it's such a problem, why do they not just increase the deposit when you pick up the keg to something substantial and to the fact that it would encourage the people to bring it back? Number two, my question is, then what do we do with the keg that we find? If we're cleaning out an estate where somebody's passed away and we find a keg, if we have a storage unit sale and we find kegs in them, and I thought there was another... or if people have brought these kegs from out of town as they're moving. You know, a lot of folks move in and out of Wyoming, and if they happen to bring a keg and they end up in Wyoming. So what do we do with the kegs? It does not, this bill does not address that. And the other thing I guess I was disappointed in is if we're going to do this, we should make it a wide range. If we're going to have the junk dealers be our police dogs, then they should be policing a lot of stuff. If people bring in new copper wiring or if they bring in pop machines, then they should have to go through all those procedures. But if you could answer those couple of questions, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Carson Seth.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chairman. This is for the good chairman. This is really hits the point of why I'm not married, because I think she's going to make me get rid of my keg lamp in my basement as soon as we tie the knot. If I go and put a deposit down on a keg, which I have done in the past, and they take my deposit, isn't that my property now?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When this bill came into the Revenue Committee, we had quite a lot of discussion on it, and the sponsor of the bill, of course, as you look who they are, gave us an excellent presentation, but there's concerns on this. I voted against this in committee for several reasons. first you look at this, and this is kind of class legislation. You're talking beer kegs here. What about the metals industry itself? There's a lot of copper wire. There are various other commodities that are being heisted from the construction industry in this time and age. And here we're focusing on kegs. And the biggest problem with this is security of your property. There is no difference between me putting my tools or firearms, laying them outside my house somewhere, and without proper security. And someone comes along, picks those up, takes them to the junk dealer, in this particular case, flowing with the bill. Then as the junk dealer has the responsibility, the junk dealer is picking up a burden here. And there's a problem with that. Because if he is found with a keg in his yard somewhere, whether it is by deliberate design or knowingly, as pointed out here, or unknowingly, he has an affirmative burden to go forward and defend himself. And I don't think that's the right intent that we have in this particular thing. So I voted against the bill, and I'd urge the body to seriously consider this, because once again, we're looking at class legislation. It doesn't include all metals, and it's shifting the burden onto the junk dealer. The junk dealer in my community is a part-time individual. He only is there about three times a week. If all of a sudden some of this stuff is dumped off and it is found in his yard and law enforcement goes by and catches him, now what's going to happen to the gentleman? Even though the perpetrator of this may come by in 3 or 4 days and says, oh, by the way, pay me for those barrels that was dumped off, he may be already in tough shape. So this has lots of problems with it, so think carefully about it.
Representative Hammonds.
Mr. Chairman, this reminds me of my freshman year where you go, oh, I have an opinion on this, and you get up and you find out that you really have limited knowledge. I have to admit, the last time I had a keg, there wasn't even anybody at the party who knew how to tap the darn thing. And then somebody finally remembered, ancient memory about knowing how to do that. However, this is of grave concern to one of my constituents who has a distributorship. And they said that this is a problem for their business and that they are charged by the brewery. And so what I hear is everybody saying, well, whose fault is it? When you rent the keg, do you own the keg? No, you own the beer inside the keg. In the same respect that when I rent a thing to move my furniture, I don't own that van. I own the right to use it, and then I return it. So the issue is, whose responsibility does this fall on? And it seems to me it's quite reasonable if I am a junk dealer and somebody leaves it at my gate, can't I just call the distributor whose name is on it and say, come pick it up? I mean, these are reasonable things, but in the same way that as a junk dealer, I can't take contraband material. If I'm a landfill, I can't take certain kinds of items. All of us as business people, in some of these things, when you take things back that you rent, you cannot take them from somebody unless you legally can take it. And so this is simply a way of leveling out the playing field and saying, this belongs to the distributor who has it from the company that sells the ingredients inside it. And so can we all work together so that we don't fill our landfills with these, not our landfills, our junkyards, and that we realize that this is contraband material. That's all we're saying, is we're identifying kegs as something that should not be crushed and used for gain of money at our junkyards. It's quite clearly that. And that's about as much as I know about that subject. And I would urge everyone to support the bill. If you have objections, amend it as it goes forward. Let's make it as good as possible. But it is a grave concern to some of the businesses in our state that many of us enjoy their product.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add to the immediate past speaker, yeah, that's true. Kegs are different. And the reason they're different than copper or different than brass or any other type of metal that a junk dealer might buy is that by definition, kegs can only be owned by a brewery legally. That means when somebody comes in with a keg, there's one of two things is possible. Either he's a thief or he's the owner of a brewery, all right? And there's no other conclusion you can have on that. And as far as, you know, having a a situation where a junk dealer isn't there and somebody throws one over the fence or something and gives it to him. There's a key word in the bill that says you have to knowingly have bought one of these or be in possession of one. So I would urge that pass this first reading on Senate File 127 because it's distinctly different than any other kind of junk that you can come up with.
Representative Zwanitzer, Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. One, I went through the statute here, and I don't see any other product or material that we're requiring junk dealers to not accept at this time, which worries me, I guess. And if the sponsor of this bill believes that we are doing special legislation. But I guess my real question is on stolen property in general. Are there not currently adequate laws in place that regard bringing in stolen property to a junk dealer or a pawn shop or anywhere else, that this is already covered somewhere else in law? I'm obviously not an attorney, but I would have to assume that if you're bringing in stolen material, which we're saying these kegs are contraband, I heard that word used, or whatever, that they're basically, if I bring in something that's a keg, and I've had the problem when I was in college, that I guess I was the landlord of the property, and we would end up with three or four kegs, don't ask me how, that were on my property the next morning, and I didn't know where they came from. I guess I could read and call those people. But my question is, isn't it somewhere else addressed in law that if you're bringing in stolen property, that there's a rationale you should not be accepting stolen property? And if any of you here in the local Cheyenne area need help tapping a keg, my number is public.
Representative Zwanitzer, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry to team up. I do have one other question. If you go on to a national buy and sell trade, like the number one site in the country or possibly in the world, you can buy beer kegs on there. So my question is that legal that I can buy a beer keg? I could give you the amount of one right now if you'd like. Is it legal to buy that? And if I do buy that legally, is it not my legal right that I could sell it for scrap? Thank you.
Chairman Gingrey.
Okay, I got quite a few questions here. I'll start at the beginning. The first question was, why can't you just increase the deposit? The difficulty with that is that that's actually not how they're mostly getting stolen. They're being stolen by employees or people coming by the liquor store and stealing them out the back and things like that. It's primarily not the customer stealing them, because in a lot of cases the customer's actually left their driver's license. So, and even if you did increase it, there seems to be a gentleman from Albany County that doesn't bring them back anyway. which raises the point that that's still not your property, even if you put a deposit. The deposit is assuring that you will bring it back, and so they have something for the value because you didn't bring it back, but it's truly their property. The copper wiring and other metals, there was another bill over in the other body that did not make it that was dealing with all those other metals, and primarily the difficulty a lot of the reporting requirements were problematic to the junk dealers. This one was a little bit different because it didn't have all the reporting requirements. It was just simply don't have one of these. Copper wiring, they can have, and so it gets more difficulty with those type of metals because you can actually accept those. You just have to record that you accepted them, and the junk dealers didn't want to go through all that recording process. That's the distinction there. The burden on the junk dealer, clearly a junk dealer does not have to accept it and say, I can't accept those. And I think it actually helps the junk dealer because now they have a means of the law to say, I really can't take that. You need to go away. The concept of people just dropping them off to the junk dealer, number one, they have a value. So I'm not sure how many people are donating them to the junk dealer. But if they did, again, it has to be a knowingly possess. And unless the prosecutor is seeing multiple times this is happening, I don't think the prosecutor is going to use his discretion to go after the first time he sees this against his local junk dealer. He's going to wait till this happens a few times. So I think if someone just leaves one there, I think that'd be fine. It's sort of the same concept we do with pawn shops, with many of the cities actually regulate pawn shops and require, you know, certain things pawn shops cannot receive. And the same idea, the concept, the policy decision being here, is instead of dealing with it on the one end of going after the actual thief, you're getting rid of the fencing ability, the ability to accept the stolen property, which is an interesting policy question, and I certainly will give that to you. And the good gentleman from Cheyenne is correct that this is a new concept, this concept of taking away the fencing ability of stolen property. What other question? I think that was most of them. Anyway, that's the concept of the bill, that we're trying to take away the ability to fence stolen property, and I would urge you to vote aye.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to get through this, but I just have to get up and speak on a bad bill. This is very selective for one unique thing, of which it's already illegal to take these barrels, these beer kegs. You know, they're leaving them outside. If someone's stealing them, it's because they're making it attractive to steal. It's very easy to steal. If it's employees stealing them, maybe they should get rid of the employees. Again, if we hadn't amended this in committee, the kegs that were under 5 gallons inside, the metal kegs, you wouldn't have been allowed to recycle those and take them to a recycling center. That would have been illegal. So we caught that one. There's a lot of other implications with this bill, and there's probably a thousand other items that should be covered like this. If we're going to do this for this case where it's already illegal for these folks, these beer kegs are all impressed into the metal. Who owns the beer keg? So it's clearly illegal to have these in possession. And again, apparently you can buy them brand new off the internet. What are you going to do about that? Is that going to be, you're going to buy something perfectly legal, but we're going to make it illegal to get rid of it when you want to?
Representative Carson.
Well, I certainly don't want to be known as a keg thief. I guess there's worse things out there, though. It still didn't answer my question, though. If the liquor store has run my deposit on my credit card, what happens next? Because this is a situation I think that occurs. I haven't heard, at least in the city, with the keg tag program that we have in my community, that a lot of shells are being stolen in the back of liquor stores anymore. That problem seems to have been solved by the municipality. But what happens? They run the deposit. I guess I'm going to have to go look at that contract that I signed with the liquor store. But how is that resolved in here? I hate to re-tap the issue.
Chairman Gingrey.
All I can say is theft is theft. They certainly can take your deposit, and they certainly can turn it over to the proper authorities to bring action against that individual that stole their property.
Is there any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the committee of the whole rise to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 127 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The chair is in doubt. I would request that those in favor stand for a division vote. Those opposed, please stand. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Anderson. Bagby. Barbudo.
Aye.
Berger.
No.
Blake.
No.
Bonner.
No.
Brechtel.
No.
Brown.
No.
Buchanan.
Aye.
Bird.
No.
Kennedy.
No.
Carson.
No.
Childers.
Aye.
Fohey.
No.
Connolly.
No.
Kraft.
No.
Davison excused. Dirks.
No.
Edmonds. Esquivel.
Aye.
Gilmore.
No.
Gingery.
Aye.
Goggles.
No.
Hales.
Aye.
Hallinan.
No.
Hammonds.
Aye.
Harshman.
No.
Harvey.
Aye.
Illaway.
No.
Yagi.
No.
Jorgensen excused. Landon.
Aye.
Lockhart.
No.
Lubno.
Aye.
Madden.
Aye.
McKim.
No.
McComey.
No.
Mercer.
No.
Meyer.
No.
Miller.
No.
Millen.
No.
Moniz.
No.
Patton.
No.
Peasley.
No.
Pedersen.
Aye.
Peterson.
No.
Philp.
No.
Korberg.
No.
Roscoe.
No.
Semlek.
Aye.
Shepperson.
No.
Stewart.
No.
Stubson.
Aye.
Teeters.
No.
Thompson.
No.
Throne.
Aye.
Wallace.
Aye.
Zwanitzer Dan.
No.
Zwanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
No.
I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Stubson. Aye to no. Berger, aye to no. Bonner, no to aye. Are there any other changes? The vote is closed. 19 ayes, 39 noes, 2 excused.
Pursuant to House Resolution or House Rule 10-5B, Senate File 127, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File Number 9. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 9, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to the state engineer regarding permit application. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, which recommend that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Wallace, Zwanitzer, Dan, Teeters. Teeters is a no. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Semlek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 9 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I will explain the bill. The activity in this bill really involves the state engineer's office, and it goes into the water title under the Board of Control. And on line 9 on the first page there, it talks about the permits that are required prior to the construction of ditches, canals, and et cetera. Really, Section A is all old language in the statute, but it does a really good job of explaining the purpose of the different things that are required for a permit in the area of our irrigation districts and those sort of things. The new language in the bill, you'll find that on page 2, line 18. This is just requesting that for this section, which just has to do with permits for surface water, not for groundwater, just for the surface water, the permits for the state engineer may be applied for or submitted electronically. So that's what B does. We've done that in a number of other agencies in state government, and the state engineer is just requesting that capability so that people in this section, again, and just in the permits for the surface water, that they can apply for these permits electronically. Section C just says that the state engineer may adopt reasonable rules and regulations in accordance with the Wyoming Administrative Procedures Act as necessary to implement this section, and that is section again refers back to B, where you can get to apply for permits electronically. Section D has to do with the rules and the regulations that are currently in effect, that were ineffective as of July 1st of 2008 and which have not been repealed or replaced as of that date and year are deemed to have been lawfully adopted in accordance with the laws and with the scope of the State Engineering Authority. So again, in addition to allowing electronic submittal of applications and granting rulemaking authority, the bill ratifies the rules in existence as of July 1st of 08. Ratification is intended to avoid any question as to the integrity of rules adopted in 1974 because what has become acceptable as rulemaking authority has evolved over the decades since. Ratification simply removes any gray area created by the existence of rules promulgated in an area when the authority to do so were different. The rules in effect today and the authorities under which they have existed have never been challenged, nor do we expect them to be. So that is the bill. I would also point out that most all state agencies have rulemaking authority, and the state engineer has rulemaking authority in the groundwater division, but they don't in the surface water division. So, if we're not going to provide rulemaking authority for the state engineer, they have to be done under policies. And policies, will work fine, but it doesn't have that sunlight like the rulemaking authority does where you can really have public comment and public hearing to make sure that the intent of the law is being promulgated by the rule. No rules can change the intent of the law. So it's what we do with every other agency. And, Mr. Chairman, that is Senate File 9, and we would ask that you ask for your favorable consideration. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rising on and against the bill. I do continually have concerns about the expansion of rulemaking authority. And on page 3, line 6, we talk about any rules or regulations implemented in this section or any predecessor to this section, which can be pretty broad. And I don't even know what all it entails. I called over to the state engineer and got a copy of the 501 rules, and this is what we're ratifying. It's a great big heavy thing. I've spoken my piece, and now I'll sit down. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where we see any predecessor, when some of those laws were recodified, Section 44 was eliminated, but there were some rules made under that section, so that's what it refers to. This bill just gives rulemaking authority, like every agency has. They have already made some rules, which have never been challenged, but they need to have that authority to operate under the Wyoming Administrative Procedures Act, which is in effect. And this cleans up a lot of things, and it's high time we took care of it in support of the bill.
Correction, Chairman Anderson. Majority Whip Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, if I understand the bill, though, the bill allows for electronic filing, but it also is giving general rulemaking authority to the state engineer's office. The rulemaking isn't limited just to the electronic submission of permits. Is that correct? It's giving overall general rulemaking authority to the state engineer.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That bill actually gives rulemaking authority to surface water. So all of 501 is the answer to that question.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Semlich's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 9 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 9 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File Number 144. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 144, introduced by Senator Dockstader. an act relating to taxation and revenue regarding property tax assessment rules. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Wallace, Semlek. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with recommendation that Senate File 144 do pass. We do have a Committee of the Whole amendment, but I don't have it in front of me, but I would move that somebody could hand that to me. I could probably... I will move that amendment, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to the bill. It, thank you. What it does is on page 3, line 13, give us a class of property, and that would simplify the things. And with that, I would ask for an aye vote on amendment.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
I'd like to turn the explanation over the bill to Representative Lubnow.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a handout on this bill. It's a whole bunch of scrawlings in my handwriting. It says in the upper left-hand corner, real estate value, and it has all kinds of charts and graphs and boxes on it. What this bill does is it requires rulemaking to ensure that the public's treated equally and provide transparency in the assessment of real property. The Constitution requires that assessments be equal and uniform. Our statutes require that all property be taxed at fair market value. What this bill does is it requires the Department of Revenue to adopt rules and regulations for appraisal methods and systems to determine the fair market value with generally accepted appraisal techniques. The Department of Revenue currently uses the CAMA system. That's computer-assisted mass appraisal. And if you look at the little chart that I handed out, there's two components for real estate value of an improvement. There's the real estate value and the improvement value. The real estate value, they use a proprietary program in Excel called SPSS, which used to stand for Statistical Program for the Social Services. It's since been changed. But what happens is you take the land economic area. And so if you have a piece of property on a river in the northwest part of the state, that's one land economic area. If you have a piece of property in the middle of the desert in the center of the state, that would be another land economic area. And so what you do is you take similarly situated parcels of land, put them in the land economic area, run those values through this SPSS program, it gets a mean value, and that's your real estate value, or REV for the equation down at the bottom. For the value of improvements, what you do is you take the CAMA system, you put in the square footage of the house, the type of construction of the house, and a whole series of values. It goes through a process, and what it calculates is the replacement cost new. So if you want to build a house with certain amenities, you run it through the CAMA system, and the CAMA system calculates the replacement cost new. Then what happens is the assessors, you get the replacement cost new, applies a neighborhood adjustment factor for the neighborhood that you're in, and it also applies a sales ratio analysis, which includes also the application of the SPSS computer system to get you the sales ratio analysis. That gets you the improvement value. You take the real estate value plus the improvement value. That's the fair market value to which you're taxed. The issue that this bill addresses is the practice of applying statistically based adjustments to the CAMA system now. Right now, the Department of Regulations does not have rules and regulations authorizing the use of the market appraisal factors or describing how the neighborhood adjustment factors are to be used. A properly designed process with studies and ratios analysis are useful in determining the level of assessment actually achieved by the CAMA system. The question is, how does the assessor properly design and apply a ratio study? What happens is you have a stratification of your real estate, the area, the number of homes, the age of the homes, where the home should be classified, the number of sales, the sample size, and how to deviate. When you do an assessment, there's a presumption of validity with the assessor. The assessor's decision is proved valid, but you're not supplied with any of that background information. So if you're a taxpayer, how do you understand and challenge the market adjustment factor? What these regulations do will provide a standard system so that you know how the adjustment factors were created and how that value is derived, so that you can evaluate the adjustments up or down, and you can make sure that our taxes are fair and transparently administered. And what the bill does, if you look on page 2, is in line 20, is that the value is computed using sales comparison methods, which require the county assessors to provide statistical parameter data to annually state to the Board of Equalization to demonstrate compliance with the rules. The rules address any adjustments that are made to the value by the county assessor, how the CAMA system works, the methods of establishing strata for the sales ratio study, in other words, what comparable pieces of property were included in your appraisal, the adequacy and the number of arm's-length sales to be used, and then any stratification to be applied to the property, as well as any market adjustment factors, so that you know, as a taxpayer, what went into the determining of the assessment of the value of your home.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I read the bill, page 2, line 22, the rules shall specifically address any adjustments made by a county assessor and input data to or assessed values obtained from the county's computer-assisted mass appraisal system. So that's input data. So how would a county assessor, or what would a rule look like that specifically addressed the adjustments? And how would an assessor lay these out for each parcel of property, and how does that differ from how the property or how the look at the individual property occurs today? If the improvement value on your chart is arrived at for each residential parcel, how then would the assessors implement this? And then the method of establishing strata for sales ratio studies is the next element. The adequacy of the number of arm's length sales to be used, and the use of appropriate statistical tests. What are appropriate statistical tests to protect against the statistical likelihood that any property in any stratum is over-assessed? What does that mean? And as I understand it, this issue is before the State Board of Equalization and will most likely be appealed to the Supreme Court. I wonder if you could comment on that at all. Thank you.
Chairman Anderson.
We don't have a comment on that, but actually what we want is the assessors to tell us what they're doing right now. That's what the rulemaking is all about. They're already doing it. We just want to make it so that the taxpayer can read what they're doing. And so the rulemaking comes from that aspect of it. Now, as far as the going to court, perhaps the attorney from Gillette can answer that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
So we want the assessors to tell us what they're doing now. How does this bill go beyond what they're doing now? Just it's those things that are laid out on that chart, as I understand it, that would require these other things on page 3 of the bill. Is that right?
Chairman Anderson.
That's the way I understand it. I mean, with rulemaking authority, then we'll have all the assessors doing essentially close to the same thing. Now it's a little bit up to the discretion. So the rulemaking needs to be out there so that they know what needs to be revealed, what the taxpayer ought to see on their adjustments. And so what we want to do is really more transparency in the tax. Property tax assessments.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just from the testimony that we heard in some counties, and it's not happening in every county, but in some counties, unfortunately, we have assessors that are basically just saying that, you know, it goes into the system, it spits it out, and here's your number. And what we were asking for was a little more transparency, that there is more to this process than just sticking some numbers into the CAMA system and it spits it out and there's your, that there is actually something that is also included outside of the CAMA system. But to answer the one question in particular, the county assessors, we did hear testimony, and they did have some issues, particularly on line 8 with the new sentence that begins the rules all the way to the end. And one of the things, and you notice in the amendment, we changed on line 13 to a class of property instead of to a property, because my issue or question was, in Laramie County, our assessor has an awful lot of properties, and if it was every single property, that's going to be an immense amount of reports that she's going to have to spit out. So we changed it to class of property, meaning the neighborhood of property when they put that adjustment factor in there. So hope that helps a little.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And addressing this, the issue with support, the one thing that having been involved in some discussions relative to this business, the rulemaking authority has to include the definition of substantially improved, meaning something that has occasioned with the property. One illustration was given to me as a residence having improved, finished the lower floor of the house, but failed to respond to the assessor when it was done, and 2 years later, then how did they come to address that substantially improved? So I'm in hopes that the rulemaking authority that is voiced and granted by virtue of this measure would help the assessor to establish that substantial improvement on ranch property acquisitions and changes of use, as well as residential and business properties. So again, I am in support of the measure.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I recollect the testimony in committee, the big issue comes with the transparency and the rule making issues comes with that. If you look at that picture that was passed out to you, it comes with that neighborhood adjustment factor. And if the author of this page has that squiggly line there, that might be indicating that after, you know, after this CAMA statistical routine has gone through and it comes up with replacement costs, and after that's all done, you know, and that's, you know, fairly obvious how that works, but after it's all done, we have what we call these neighborhood adjustment factors, and it turns out that every county has a series of neighborhood or assessment neighborhoods, let's call them, and there's a certain homogeneity between properties within that, and the issue is, you know, how are those neighborhoods established, and what is it that differs from one neighborhood to the other in terms of these adjustments? And the same thing goes through with respect to the sales ratio analysis, where you look at, you know, sales that are occurring relative to the market values that have been established and things like that. And I guess to reiterate, one of the things that came through loud and clear is that this transparency varies from one county to the other in a very substantial sense, and it's hoped that this effort in this bill will solve a lot of that.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for Senate File 144, we heard testimony in committee that one of the issues and one of the explanations in counties outside this area, and not my county, but the assessor was saying that the legislature had put this in statute, that this is the way it's interpreted, and this is why it's, you know, very difficult for them to explain. They need to go talk to their legislators. That wasn't really true. This bill goes a long way to make the assessors think a little bit more. And we heard testimony in committee that, for example, one county had about 75 different property classes, and in one property class there's 1,200 individual properties. So for that particular class of property, they come up with one explanation. And if someone wants to contest that class of property, they've got one copied. Here's the way we calculated it. That's what we wanted to do, is come up with a logical explanation that's universal and applies to the properties within that class. Apparently, they come up with whatever they can think of at the time someone challenges them on one of these right now. So this is going to make them think a little bit. Your assessor probably does not like this bill. As I said, it wasn't the assessor from where I'm from that had made that comment, or someone that said that's the comment they made. It was some other county. So I don't want the speaker's mother-in-law to give me a ring.
Madam Majority Whip Corberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to figure out how this is all going to work. And while I'm all for transparency, I'm not sure. I guess I'm kind of wondering out loud. I'm just thinking out loud if we're getting transparency confused with the process itself. I mean, I guess from my own perspective, our county assessor is extremely transparent and can tell you exactly how she arrived at what she did. So are we taking all latitude away from county assessors here with this promulgation of rules and regs about any latitude? I mean, I guess I'm wondering perhaps why they might even be elected anymore. I mean, I'm just trying to think this through, but some of this is bothersome to me, like the adequacy of the number of arm's length sales. Sometimes in a small area, their arm length sales, they might not have any at all, actually, or maybe even one. I don't know. I just have some concerns about this bill at this time.
Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We may be creating more problems here than we're solving. I think that when you get into this and you're going to ask the assessors to do these things, I need to tell you that when I do a market analysis in the real estate business, it takes me 3 hours. I have a computer program that I use. I have to collect other information about size, rooms, the neighborhood, and all of that goes into the computer to make some kind of an analysis. And you're going to be asking the assessors to do that. One, I don't think they have the time. I don't think they have the resources to do this. And I'm not sure that the things that you're asking here are going to give any more information to the people who want to challenge the information that's being given. And I'm sure that it's not going to add any transparency to the process.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you. For one answer, where there's perhaps no sales, there are a lot of small towns around the state that have no sales, maybe for 2 years. Those assessments are made on replacement value less depreciation. The assessors have that and do it now. As far as making more work for everybody, we want some transparency. They need to have
a reason for assessing those things. The department assured us that they're already working on those rules, and this will just expedite that a little bit. Some of those things can be put into the CAMA system. They've already investigated that, and the people have assured them that another program can be added to it for a few dollars, like I think they quoted $100,000. That's just a few. But the department can absorb that. It's a lot less than what they expected on that thing. Again, we're after transparency. People who get their property taxes want to know why. And there's no reason they shouldn't know why. And after we put the class of property in, the assessors were not quite so concerned with the last big paragraph on page two as they were before that, when they thought each building would have to be assessed separately or have a worksheet on that. This is, again, if you want transparency in government, this is a step in the right direction.
Madam Majority Whip Corbett.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I guess language like on page 3, line 7, that, or let's start at line 6, that says the use of appropriate statistical tests to protect against the statistical likelihood that any property in any stratum is overassessed. I'm just concerned that we're moving away from mass appraisal into almost individual appraisals of each residential property, and there's a very big difference between the way county assessors appraise for taxation purposes, which is really based, you know, it is based on mass appraisal rather than an individual appraisal of each resident. So I'm not sure I like this bill.
Representative Lubnow, you've waited very patiently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's back up and let's talk about what the rules are that exist right now. We, by statute, required the Department of Revenue to promulgate some rules. And the rules as they exist right now say that the appraisal techniques which may be used by the county assessor, the ad valorem decision under each written agreement with the county, include the approaches described in this section. Each approach shall be used as an appropriate method for the type of property being valued. That is, the property shall fit the assumptions inherent in each appraisal method in order to calculate or estimate the fair value of the property. So those are the existing regulations. Well, what do? Well, we tell them to use the sales comparison approach. The comparable sales approach is an appropriate method of valuation when there's an adequate number of reliable arm's length and sales and property subject to such sales are similar to the property being valued. Comparable sales shall be adjusted to reflect the differences in time, location, size, physical attributes, financing terms, or other differences which affect value. The use of this approach to value depends on the availability of comparable sales data, the verification of sales data, the degree of comparability or extent of adjustment necessary for time differences, and the absence of non-typical conditions affecting the sales price. Then we can use the cost approach, the income or capitalized earnings approach, where we take the amount of rent that a piece of property receives, multiply it times a factor, and that gets you the income or earnings approach. And then we authorize the CAMA system. Section 8 of those rules provides that the fair market value of all taxable property shall be determined by applying the methods of valuation outlined above. In all cases, additions, deletions, and changes in use will be recognized by appraisers, and appropriate adjustments will be made to the valuation of property. So we already have all of these rules that tell how to value the property. We're not changing any of those rules. What we're doing is we're just saying, tell us what the heck you were doing. Remove the mystery. Whatever adjustment factors that you put in, tell us what they are. If you look at the chart, all of the what the rules talk about in simple language, if you look at the adjustments made by the county assessor in input data 2, okay? If you look at the top of the CAMA system, all of those arrows going in, those are the values. We're saying, what did you put into the CAMA system so that you got, we know what comes out the other side? All the CAMA system is a computer program that you put in these variables, and it spits out the replacement cost new. So if you're going to build a house and you want four bathrooms, five bedrooms, you want a marble foyer, you want a two-car garage, you stick all of those values in, and out the other end comes the replacement cost new. Then we require the assessors to make a whole bunch of adjustments based upon the neighborhood. Well, what do we ask them to qualify? Are they single family? Are you being compared with single family dwellings, or are you being compared with duplexes or condominiums? Who are you being compared with? Are you dividing out certain streets in the neighborhood versus certain other streets in the neighborhood? And we're asking them to do this on every assessment, so all we're asking them to do is to tell us what they were doing and do it in a uniform way so that everybody's treated the same in the state. There's not a lot of mystery here. Now, my good friend, the Senate of the Appropriation, or the Chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, who is one of the co-sponsors on this bill, did use the language that says use of appropriate statistical tests to protect against the statistical likelihood that any property in any stratum is overassessed. What does that mean? That means, what are the protections to make sure the assessment's fair? I mean, there's no voodoo in that language. That's what that says. Now, with respect to the good question of the speaker, I understand that there is some litigation ongoing. I understand that the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee is involved in that litigation. That's one of two bills that my name is on that I found out about it shortly before I had to present the bill on the floor. That litigation isn't affected by this bill. This bill will change everything prospectively. Whatever happened in that litigation is going on prior to this date, and it will be assessed the way that it was assessed. So, yes, there's a case pending. In the interest of full disclosure, you're all entitled to know that. The assessors are already doing this, because we, by rule, tell them that they have to do this. All we're asking them to do is to remove the mystery, tell us what the transparency is, and tell us how they arrived at the value of your house. And if you're taxing somebody and there's a presumption of validity on those taxes, that taxpayer is entitled to know how that value is calculated.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
Just a question. I may have missed it because my mind couldn't follow the rapid course of the rules. But page 2, line 20 and 21, it says, computed using sales comparison methods. When I read that and thought I'd stand up and ask a question, I read it differently. And as I read it now, the sales comparison methods are then described further in the bill, in rule, in this bill that requires rulemaking to establish the rules that is for the sales comparison methods. And so I guess my fundamental question is, what is the name of the method we use right now? I know we use the CAMA system, but what is the method? And what's the rule?
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The name of the method is the sales comparison approach. And we also have a cost approach and an income capitalized earnings approach. The cost would be replacing the facility. The income capitalized earning approach would be capitalizing the rents to determine value, and then there's the sales comparison approach. This only requires rules applying to the values computed using the sales comparison methods, which are in Chapter 9 entitled Ad Valorem Validation Methodology and Assessment Local Assessments, and are on pages 74 to 86. And the section is Section 6A, Section 6 being appraisal methods and the subsection being A.
Representative Hammonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. these last few years as I've worked on property tax, I know that first you come at it from two directions. One, do we have a fair system in our state so that you can assure people back home that the system that's being used, is it fair? And then you get into, are they charging you too much? Can you afford to be there? And so we as a body have argued that. But when you really look at the system and you talk to your constituents, not just about what can they afford to pay, but how did they arrive at the value of their property and how much they're being assessed, and you remember those stories that they told you, as I read this bill, it takes care of every single constituent who called me and had a story about how there were real issues with how their property had been assessed. In fact, I have absolute respect for our county assessor. I just think she does an outstanding job. And I would stand in front of any group of constituents in our county and speak highly of her. But our current system limits you. If you're talking about a residential property, you have to find five comparators. If you're talking about a commercial property, you talk about three comparators. And you can imagine in the smaller communities how problematic that is for those individuals. I'll give you an anecdote. I have a friend who she and her husband were able to buy a house that was being foreclosed on. And so they got it at a very reduced amount. No one wanted to buy it. Well, why did no one want to buy it? When it had first been built, it was the finest brick house in this particular part of town. But as time had gone by, it was not zoned. And so on both sides of that property, there had gone, on one side there's a feed and lumber yard, and on the other side there's a rental place for heavy equipment. And in between the two is this lovely brick house. Well, when she went in to find out why they kept assessing her property at such a high rate, she found out it was being compared to every other high-end brick house in our community, which had been built 16 years after her property. And so there are examples of that that are in all of our communities. And people, all they're saying is, how are you choosing to say what the assessed valuation of my property is? And what this bill does, in a very non-threatening way, it says, let's have rules so people can find out much more easily how their county assessor came up with the valuation of their property. It's not changing the rules. It's simply making them more transparent. And for that reason, I'll be voting for this particular bill.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the descriptions that you've heard so far, the conversation you've heard so far, I want you to know I haven't changed my support for this measure. The transparency is one of the factors. Uniformity across the state is another factor, and that is a part and a major part of this measure. But lastly, let me tell you that not all assessors treat the public the same way. There are assessors across the state that refuse to give the transparency, what were the comparables within your neighborhood for that property. The people of Wyoming, had not too many years ago, said we didn't want the sales price of our property to be revealed in public records. So we abolished that. So the result of that is you do the best you can by the comparables of actual sales. And that is a part of the system that is in place today. But one of the things that is important that I think is important, the written explanations required to be maintained by the county assessor shall be public records available to a taxpayer upon request. Most assessors already comply with that. We are now in the position of saying all assessors should make that record available. And that, I've got to say, is a positive movement towards what we're doing with our tax policy. Again, my support for the measure.
Speaker Pro Tem.
Mr. Chairman, I have a few concerns with this bill, I think, and one of the things I'd like to ask is, it talks about sales comparisons and the use of appropriate statistical tests, and I would just like to know what those tests are and how many there are that the assessor has to apply. I don't know. I'm not very good at tests, so I'd like to know what these statistical tests are. I don't think they're those kind of tests. Anyway, apparently they have to keep this written record for every property in the county, and it seems to me that that will be a whole lot of work. I think it'll be pretty hard for the assessors to do that without having extra help and all that kind of thing. And this bill, I don't see a fiscal note on it, but and I can understand that on request that property owners ought to be able to get those records, but this bill seems to me that it makes it so that they have to do it on every property, whether that's requested or not. And I just wonder if that's what the bill really says or was really intended to say. And so anyway, until I can hear different, I'm going to vote no on this bill.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to ask the second part of that question, because I'm not going to get into the statistical tests that they have or they're used to look at the valuations. But the second part of the question, we heard testimony from one of the larger counties that they basically have 75 classes of property, and the largest class of those 75 had 1,200 properties within that. So they only need one explanation for all 1,200 properties. So that's the way I understand the purpose of especially that language on page 3, that they can come up with one explanation for those 1,200 properties. They all fall in the same class. They increase their tax or decrease their tax by this percentage based on this information. So they're not going to maintain an individual explanation for each individual property. They will for each class of property.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe we're getting a little too hung up on the specific details here. The CAMA system is a source of frustration for taxpayers. I've received emails from all over the state. I have local constituents who are frustrated. This House already passed two bills that I was the prime sponsor on to help ensure procedural fairness. I see this as a more technical bill to also help assure taxpayers of some procedural fairness in the process. CAMA is a model. It's only as good as the information you plug into it, and I don't think it's unreasonable to require by rule the county assessors and through the Department of Revenue to ensure that their system is working appropriately. Because once you get into a tax appeal situation, if it's determined that the assessor followed CAMA and CAMA applied, you're in a pretty difficult situation. So I think I see this part and parcel with some of the bills we already passed to help ensure procedural fairness. It may need to be tweaked, but I think it's a good approach to give some assurance to our taxpayers. Thank you.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer the good questions of the Speaker Pro Tem, what is the statistical test to protect against? Well, if you look on that little handout that I handed out, there's that bell curve that goes up and down. The rulemaking will decide how far into that bell curve you have to apply, whether 90% of the properties. What you don't want is you don't want your property valued way as an outlier on the real small part of the bell curve. And so that's what the bill asks you to do, is just to make sure that you're within one or two standard deviations so that 95% of the value of the property falls within the same property valuation, so that your property value isn't an absolute outlier, and that if they use this cost approach, this cost method, that's in the bill, the computed sales comparison method, that you're not an outlier and that your calculation is fair. With respect to keeping records, you got to keep in mind that the assessors are doing this already. They're already doing these kind of things because we've required them by statute and then following rule to do this. We're just requiring them to tell us what they did. What neighborhood, what 1,200 parcels of property you're being compared with. So that's what we're trying to do, is to make sure that the strata that you're classified in matches the value of your property, so that if you so that you're sure that your taxes are fair and that you have the opportunity to protest if your taxes aren't fair, because when it's a mystery, you can't say. And I kind of find it offensive that people would argue that we should keep the mystery there so that people aren't able to protest their taxes. The whole point of a taxation system is that it should be fair and uniformly and evenly applied. And so telling people, or telling our assessors to tell people how they came to the value of their property, seems an appropriate and absolutely reasonable thing to do.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. Maybe this has already been discussed and I just missed it. I thought there was a bill that was also coming where the statement of considerations are confidential and that someone was going to make it so they're not confidential. If they're not confidential, or if they stay confidential, let's say that bill doesn't make it. The difficulty is that on line 15, it says the written explanations required to be maintained by the county assessor shall be public records available to a taxpayer upon request. So if the other bill doesn't pass, something that's confidential essentially could be given out, or there's a conflict in the law. The other concern I had is the use of the word a taxpayer. So just even if it's not my property, I could go in and just find out everything about your property and have all that information as to market values and all that. And I thought the objective was to not give out that information so it didn't affect the real estate market. My other concern is just simply, and it's just a policy question, we keep adding on rules and regulations onto the county assessors promulgated by the Department of Revenue. At some point, I mean, and this bill certainly goes a long ways toward it, I mean, we need to have that policy discussion. Do we continue to have county assessors elected, or, as this bill wants to seem to do, just turn it over to the Department of Revenue and get rid of the elected officials? You know, personally, I like having the elected official. I like having the county assessor elected. If she's not doing her job right, we elect a new one, and I don't have to rely on a bureaucrat in Cheyenne. But this clearly is heading in that direction, where we're not allowing the elected official to do their job. We're going to have the Department of Revenue do their job for them, and I just disagree with that concept.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that the good representative from Teton County misunderstands the purpose and the process of this bill. This isn't to take the elected official out of the process. As a matter of fact, it's to keep the elected official in the process. It's just to ask the elected official to tell us what in the world they did and how in the world they arrived at the value, and put that in a quantified kind of way. With respect to the openness of those records, I think an amendment might be appropriate to make it any interested taxpayer, or the appropriate language there, and I'd work with the good chairman to do that. As you understand, the first sentence is promulgate rules and regulations. So what we're asking for is a promulgation of rules and regulations, but I would be amenable and would work with the good chairman on clarifying that language so that it's not anybody who has access, but only those parties who are interested in the value of a particular piece of property.
Is there any further discussion on this bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion, that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 144 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
Senate File 144 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration,
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Ladies and gentlemen, move Senate File 60 down below 101 and 56 down below 107.
The next file, or the next bill for our consideration, is Senate File 115. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 115, introduced by Senator Larson, an act relating to public funds, investment of state funds revision. This file was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Stubson, Vice Chair.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 115 do pass, and I'd like to turn the explanation of the bill over to the former Speaker of the House, once removed, to explain the bill.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, this morning you passed on third reading Senate File 146, which dealt with the funding of the NCAR computer slated for construction here in the southeastern part of the state over the next year or two. Within that bill, it has some discussion about the Industrial Revenue Bond Program that the state currently has and some form of funding with the University of Wyoming using flows from mineral severance tax that currently flows into the University of Wyoming should they so need it. What the bill does before you, Senate File 115, for a number of years, the state of Wyoming has had a program in place where up to $100 million could be issued in the form of bonding for certain projects through municipalities and counties and joint powers boards. What this bill does is extends that date, the sunset date that you find in the bill, from June 30, 2009. It extends it two further years. You might say, what do these two have to do with one another? Well, the funding of the NCAR supercomputer ultimately is to be borne by the NCAR facility itself. The UCAR is to fund that particular installation here in the state of Wyoming. But in the short term, how does that get paid for? And with the memorandum of understanding between UCAR, NCAR, the University of Wyoming, and the state of Wyoming, short-term prospects are to allow the county here, which we all are sitting in at this particular time, to issue industrial revenue bonds, and the movement of the sunset date allows for the state treasurer, should he so need to do that, is to purchase those bonds sometime between now and June 30, 2011. That's as confusing an explanation as I can offer, and I stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 115 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Senate File 115 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 113. The reading clerk will read the bill. Make that 115. Sorry about that.
13.
No. 13.
Senate File 13, introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to game and fish regarding shed antler collection. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Brown, Childers, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, Millen, Shepperson, Thompson. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Childers.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that bill number, or that Senate File 13 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And I will turn it over to the good representative from House District 58 to explain both.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Do we want to hear the explanation first? Are you ready for the question?
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'd like to explain the Standing Committee Amendment.
Okay. Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And ladies and gentlemen, the Standing Committee Amendment basically changes entirely what the body at the other end of the hall did. This was an interim committee bill that started out under the harassment statutes. The body at the other end of the hall basically put a ban on the collection of antlers and wanted to implement a season for gathering those. Our committee disagreed with that wholeheartedly, so we went back to basically regulating the control of antlers and horns for big game animals pursuant to harassment and disturbance of big game populations. And the only area that this was a concern was the southwest corner of the state. So in order to try to minimize the effects of this and to not expand any agency authority, we said that this only pertains to the land west of the Continental Divide. And there's a map in your tray that shows the Continental Divide boundary, so it's basically just the southwest corner of the state. So with that, I would take any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, and that's basically the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill at this point.
Are you ready for the question? You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment number one. Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. The Standing Committee Amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I struggle with the concept of a state agency regulating the collection of antlers, period. I fundamentally do not believe that it's the right and role of government to do that. It is already illegal to harass wildlife. I don't understand what the intent of this legislation is. I don't know why we need it other than an expansion of authority. We've got people that think that for some reason that you're going to be able to ban this and it's going to stop the problem. But if they're already breaking the law, they're going to continue to break the law. And I just strongly oppose the bill. I urge you to vote no.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I can sure understand the good representative from House District 5's concerns. I had those same concerns myself. We did hear a lot of testimony in committee about the need for this. Basically, what has happened is Colorado, Utah, and Idaho, or I guess states all around us, sorry about that, have enacted legislation banning this. And so what's happening is people are coming in with their trucks and their trailers and just lining up at the gate and hauling them away by the trailer load and doing all sorts of other things to collect these horns. We've also heard testimony that sometimes with stuff this, with a law like this in effect from January through May, that the game wardens get all the horns and sell them. And that is a concern of mine also. And that's why we tried to make this as restrictive as possible. It's only on public lands west of the Continental Divide between January and May 1 of each year. So we do understand your concerns and tried to make it as restrictive as possible.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we also heard testimony that there are some people that are actually rigging up wires to knock the horns off the animal. And it's so bad in a couple of counties that the county commissioners have actually passed regulations to stop it. I'm not talking about casual hunting for antlers. I'm talking about intentional harassment of the animals and a for-profit gathering of horns. And then there's also people that pride themselves of getting the horns from the same animal every year, and they'll stake out to do that. And again, the problem is on public lands, and again, the problem is in southwest Wyoming. We are not proposing to do this in other parts of the state. That's why you see the language in the standing committee amendment, and it shows the boundary in the map that was passed out. It is a big problem with the big bucks in the southwest part of the state, that people are coming in from across the state line and doing this. Now, you could say that the county could take care of it, but on the other hand, the Game and Fish is supposed to regulate harassment, and we discussed at length, how do you determine handling harassment? We really couldn't figure out a way to do it, and we'd basically need more than an interim study to handle harassment. So the purpose of the bill is to try to take care of a problem that they have in a selected part of the state. On and for the bill.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit of history. In southwest Wyoming, the animals spend their time in the summertime clear up on top of the mountains, and in the winter, as the high or the deep snow comes, they just migrate into the flatlands, the sagebrush, where there isn't a lot of cover. They're very vulnerable to a lot of, well, they're visible. People come from all over to look at them, and that's not so bad. But when they start looking at the antlers they carry, a set of antlers that was at a 36-inch plus that were shed, perfect match in the 200 category, Boone and Crockett, they were offered $30,000 for a set of sheds. And this makes it not just a casual antler shedding group. This is folks that are in it for big bucks. And the vulnerability of these animals in southwest Wyoming, when they're out of the mountains, they're down on the flatlands, the sagebrush, the plains, they are, as they get moved around, they're going to die. I mean, they're just the young deer. The testimony that we heard, sometimes when they're just moved at the wrong condition, that movement causes death. And so it's really a serious problem. And as I said, people come from all over. It's kind of where I live. And I used to take my kids out to do this. I just quit doing it because there was so many people there. It's not fun anymore. It's turned into a business. And that's kind of what we're saying here, that we really do need help in southwest Wyoming. And I think this is kind of a compromise that we've worked with lots of people, leaving some clear alone, but where we live, I think it's just a necessary thing. So I'd really urge you to adopt this. Thank you.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you are artificially hazing or moving wildlife right now, it is already illegal. And that is why I cannot figure out what this bill is trying to accomplish. Granted, it is a little better than the Senate version, but the concept is still intellectually bankrupt, in my opinion. I don't think that, unless you catch someone actually doing this, how are you going to find them? Are they going to go around looking at people who have shed antlers and say, where did you collect those, and then be issuing citations? I don't know how that's going to work. But if they are actually caught in the act of hazing an animal with the intent of trying to knock the antlers off, that's already illegal. So we definitely we don't need this piece of legislation.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. People in my area, the northwest end of the state, were also questioning why the need for this bill. The committee had email after email from people who, as an avocation, not as a commercial enterprise, but to just enjoy going out in the hills picking up shed antlers. But when they really chilled is when the words were added in the other end of the this building that a ban, where needed, the department would have the authority to put in place a ban. Worried that that ban, where needed, would morph into a broader ban. However, that's why the committee in the House has hearing of the problem in Southwest Wyoming and responding to that and wanting to treat that particular problem has modified the bill in the manner that they have to keep not and to get rid of the word ban and to give authority to promulgate rules and regulations to deal with a situation where it needs to be dealt with and will not extend beyond. And the final word is from people that have corresponded with me in my end of the state. They're all right with that. They want to deal with that problem. So out of all of that, coming all the way around to where we are today, on and for the bill. Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against Senate File 13, and the reason why is, to me, it looks like, you know, if you're out on an April fishing trip and you run across some antlers, you know, frankly, I've never found more than one or two in a day, and I'm not even looking for them. It's just when you're out doing something that you stumble onto these things. Most of the time, I just leave them there. But, you know, I've seen maybe two in a day. Usually, I've never seen a match pair by any means. But what happens if you're out there with your child, you're on a fishing trip, he finds an antler, and you pick it up and bring it in? Is he illegal on this bill if it's before May 1st? This is what I think we need a limit here. You know, if you got a backpack with 30 antlers on it, okay, that's fine. But if it's one antler, that's why I oppose this bill.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we've made it clear, number one, that it's going to be in a selected part of the state. Number two, they are going to develop rules and regulations for that part of the state. Two of the counties in that part of the state have already done things and would like to do it. And the problem with harassment, you can't do it. You can't handle it. Yes, it's against the law, but how do you prove it? The good representative from the other part of the state has indicated that. But what they're going to be developing are rules and regulations to handle this in that part of the state. And yes, there may be a season on it, but I think that the counties that are having major problems with that, with harassment of the animals, and it's difficult to handle harassment, that's why we're doing it this way. I mean, the House didn't particularly like the way the bill came to us. So that's what we're changing. We're trying to narrowly define it. We had a long discussion with the department about this, and the landowners in other parts of the state that are concerned that it was affecting private property rights, look at the amendment. The amendment says public lands only. So I think we've narrowed the bill down to do the right thing and to take care of a local problem. So I would say on and for the bill.
Representative Brown.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find it interesting that all the people that are complaining about this bill aren't going to be affected by it. I don't hear anybody that's going to be affected by this bill or have constituents that are going to be affected by this bill up at the microphone. The fact of the matter is, in the part of the state, we rewrote this, and we wrote it as narrowly as we possibly could. And the people in the part of the state that are going to be regulated by this bill want it. They want this regulation. And as far as harassment versus hazing versus whatever, there are too many variations and too many degrees of that. And we're asking the game and fish people to do something that's just too hard to say, well, is it hazing, is it harassing, or what? And then we heard one anecdotal complaint about some people who were prevented from harassing the game, and then they wandered off, and the game warden walked over and picked up the rack and walked off with maybe a $30,000 rack. So there's just too much variability in that. There's too much judgment. It's too hard to prosecute. And that part of the state is different. They are not the big sagebrush flats. They're not the kind of country that everybody that I've heard up at this microphone is talking about. These animals are in deep snow country. They go down in very confined regions in the winter. They don't have the ability to flee and the ability to drift around that animals in the rest of the state do. And so if you live east of the Continental Divide, please understand it's a different situation west of the Continental Divide. And if I'm wrong, somebody from west of the Continental Divide get up and tell me you don't want it, because I don't hear that. So on and for the bill.
Representative Roscoe, west of the divide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am from the heart of this country, and I think this bill is, I think you guys did a great job of dividing it up, and I have some friends that are antler hunters, and they do wait until the proper time, and it's still exciting, and I do think we need it for our elk and deer herds, on and for the bill. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Chilbert's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 13 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Senate File 13 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 57. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 57, introduced by the Transportation Committee, an act relating to rental vehicle agencies. This bill was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which respectfully reports back with recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Hallinan, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Swanitzer, Dave, signed, Representative Cohey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Cohey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 57 do pass. There is a standing committee amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I do move its adoption at this time. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 57. Members of the House, if you look on page 3, line 21, the bill discusses the placement of a license in a particular rental vehicle's establishment, and the committee's wisdom determined that the license be displayed in a conspicuous place. So, Mr. Chairman, what it does is add the word conspicuously. I so move adoption of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
Question having been called, all those in favor for Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the House, Senate File 57 is a study of and statutory regulation of non-commercial rental vehicles in the state of Wyoming. In 1994, Wyoming enacted some legislation, but considered fine at the time, but it needs a lot of amendments. It required at that time a 4% surcharge on all rental contracts of trucks and vehicles in a non-commercial sense. Ultimately, what happened is they collected a 4% surcharge on all these vehicles, and if the dealers registered their vehicles in the state of Wyoming, there would be credit allowed for that 4% surcharge, but currently we find that there are some issues. Currently, our statute says that rental agencies are required to obtain a rental vehicle agency certificate from YDOT. It currently states that rental vehicles are exempt from registration in Wyoming as long as they are legally registered in another jurisdiction. It states that you drive vehicles and rental companies are required to pay the 4% surcharge, that rental agencies are already allowed to retain the 4% and use it as an offset if they register their vehicles in the state of Wyoming. And it also finds any funds left after the registration offset are shared between YDOT and the counties. Since 1994 and more recently, responsible rental companies have shown some concern
that the surcharge fees in the state of Wyoming have gone way down, even though the registration fees of rental vehicles have stayed fairly stable. The numbers of registrations, well, additionally, while the appearance of underreporting has been evident, our statistics show that that we don't have the means of accountability or penalty or even enforcement to deter false reporting. While working on the issue during the interim of 2008, the Joint Committee suggested that a committee of county treasurers, rental companies, YDOT personnel get together, and they did that and come up with a lot of changes, most of them which in this bill. The big items in the bill, you'll find that the requirements are an operating certificate for each location of each company must be obtained and renewed annually and prominently be displayed at the location of each agency, that the agency or the company at each location must indicate the firm's permanent location of operation and a listed permanent telephone number and an adequate signage out on the property where the location or the facility exists, and that the books and the rental contract records are to be kept and maintained at that particular property for auditing of our state, or not the auditor, but the auditing arm of the Department of Revenue or YDOT personnel. The bill goes on to discuss serious consequences of failure to comply with the statute. You'll find that and through the bill, but particularly on page 9 and then on pages 16, 17, and 18. The bill requires reporting twice a year and then when the surcharge report must be filed once a year and what is to be included in the reporting document. Mr. Chairman, that's an explanation of the bill, and I stand for questions.
Is there any further discussion of the bill? Representative Brechtel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if I didn't see anything that exempts rental of farm equipment or ATVs, and I guess it's just a question, but was that the intended in here? It seems to me, as I read the definition of motor vehicles, that they're really not exempted in statute.
Chairman Cohey.
That's an excellent question, Mr. Chairman, but it just basically deals with vehicles that are required a registration that you find in sections 3119, 101, 104, 106, and 107.
Is there any other discussion? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion. No, Chairman Cohey's motion. That when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 57 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Senate File 57 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 101.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries.
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. Speaker, Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. Senate File 72, amended, recommended, do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the House be in recess till 2 p.m. The House reconvened at 2 p.m. Senate File 84, amended and further amended, recommended, do pass. Senate File 37, amended, recommended, do pass. Senate File 23, recommended, do pass. Senate File 127, amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. Senate File 9, recommended, do pass. Senate File 144, amended, recommended, do pass. Senate File 115, recommended, do pass. Senate File 13, amended, recommended, do pass. Senate File 57, amended, recommended, do pass. Signed, Representative Hallinan, Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Thank you, Representative Hallinan. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 324. Mr. Speaker, Senate Joint Resolution, hydraulic fracturing. The Senate failed to concur on the House amendments to the bills as below by the vote indicated, ayes 0, noes 30. The Senate requests the House appoint a conference committee number 1 to meet with a like committee from the Senate to report the recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 327, Mr. Speaker, House Bill 25, Special License Plate Retention by Spouse. The Senate adopted the Joint Conference Committee number 1 on the bill listed above by the vote indicated, ayes 26, noes 4, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 328, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed Senate on third reading by the vote indicated, House Bill 100, Omnibus Water Bill Planning, ayes 30, no 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 329, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated, House Bill 111, Clean Coal Task Force, ayes 28, noes 2, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 330, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated, House Bill 145, Rural Health Care Districts Mill Levy, ayes 26, noes 4, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 331, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated, House Bill 195, Real Estate Act Amendments, ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Mr. Speaker, message 332, House Bill 207, the House bill listed above, passed on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated, ayes 29, noes 1. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 333, Mr. Speaker, House Bill 226, State Lands Grazing Fees. The House bill listed above passed on a third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated, ayes 22, noes 5, conflict 3. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 334, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated, House Bill 235, Child Protection Case Planning, ayes 30, no 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 335, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated, House Bill 241, Criminal Background Checks Retirement System, ayes 27, noes 3, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 336, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated, House Bill 251, Trusts Retirement Funds Accounting, ayes 30, no 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 337, Mr. Speaker, the President appointed Senate conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the House on amendments to Senate Joint Resolution 5. The Senate conferees are Senator Bebout, Chairman, Senator Jennings, Senator Hastert, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 339, Mr. Speaker, House Bill 62, Charter School Law Amendments. The Senate adopted the Joint Conference Committee number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated, ayes 27, noes 3, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 340, Mr. Speaker, the Senate did concur on House amendments to the bills listed below by the vote indicated, Senate File 69, Fertilizers, ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 341, Mr. Speaker, the Senate did concur on House amendments to bills listed below by the vote indicated, Senate File 73, Gillette-Madison Pipeline Project, ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Conference Committee number one for Senate Joint Resolution 5, Hydraulic Fracturing. Chairman Lockhart, Chair Gilmore, and Stubson. That's Senate Joint Resolution 5, Lockhart, Chair Gilmore, and Stubson. And Senate File 6, Chairman is Childers with Conley and Brown. Senate File 6, Chair is Childers with Conley and Brown. Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred Senate File 94, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Lubnow, Miller, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dan. Signed, representing Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred Senate File 102, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Lubnow, Miller, Stubson. No, Swanitzer, Dan. Signed, representing Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred Senate File 112, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brown, Hales, Lubnow, Miller, Stubson. No, Kraft, Dirks, Illaway, Swanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Brown, Vice Chair. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 99, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe. No, Brechtel, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, representing Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 135, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson. No, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
Are there any re-referrals? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to re-refer Senate File 135 and Senate File 99 to your committee number 2, Appropriations.
Hearing no objection, it is ordered. With that order, business of signing of enrolled acts. The reading clerk will read the enrolled act.
House Enrolled Act number 24, being original House Bill 51, an act relating to motor vehicles authorizing insurance of handicap license plates, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 25, being original House Bill number 51. I have so signed.
House Enrolled Act number 25, being original House Bill 74, an act relating to water and sewer districts, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 25, being original House Bill number 74. I have so signed.
House Enrolled Act number 26, being original House Bill number 78, an act relating to improvement in service districts, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 26, being original House Bill number 78. I have so signed.
House Enrolled Act number 27, being original House Bill number 79, an act relating to real estate mortgages, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 27, being original House Bill number 79. I have so signed.
House Enrolled Act number 28, being original House Bill 106, an act relating to criminal procedure, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 28, being original House Bill number 106. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 29 being original House Bill 113, an act relating to the regulation of traffic being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 29 being original House Bill number 113. Have so signed.
House and World Act number 30 being original House Bill 135, an act relating to the liability of owners of land regarding private land for parking, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 30 being original House Bill number 135. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 31 being original House Bill number 137, an act relating to criminal procedure, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign House and World Act number 31 being original House Bill number 137. Have so signed.
House and World Act number 32 being original House Bill number 150, an act relating to peace officers, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 32 being original House Bill number 150. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 33 being original House Bill number 155, an act relating to higher education matching fund programs, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 33 being original House Bill number 155. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 34 being original House Bill number 182, an act relating to limited liability companies, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 34 being original House Bill number 182. Have so signed.
House and World Act number 35 being original House Bill number 221, an act relating to property taxation, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 35 being original House Bill number 221. Have so signed.
House and World Act number 36 being original House Bill number 2, an act relating to motor vehicles, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 36, which is original House Bill number 2. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 37 being original House Bill 10, an act relating to subdivisions, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 37 being original House Bill number 10. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 38 being original House Bill 16, an act regarding licenses and license transfers, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 38 being original House Bill number 16. Have so signed.
House and World Act number 39 being original House Bill 34, an act relating to alcoholic beverages, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 39 being original House Bill number 34. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 40 being original House Bill number 48, an act relating to game and fish, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 40 being original House Bill number 48. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 41 being original House Bill number 75, an act relating to subdivisions, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 41 being original House Bill number 75. I have so signed.
House and World Act number 42 being original House Bill 80, an act relating to unitization of carbon sequestration sites, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 42 being original House Bill number 80. Have so signed.
House and World Act number 43 being original House Bill number 100, an act relating to water development projects, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and roll Act number 43 being original House Bill number 100.
I have so signed.
House and Rule Act number 44, being original House Bill 111, an act relating to the Clean Coal Task Force, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and Rule Act number 44, being original House Bill number 111. I have so signed.
House and Rule Act number 45, being original House Bill 145, an act relating to rural health care districts, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and Rule Act number 45, being original House Bill number 145. I have so signed.
House and Rule Act number 46, being original House Bill number 195, an act relating to the Real Estate License Act of 1971, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and Rule Act number 46, being original House Bill number 195. I have so signed.
House and Rule Act number 47, being original House Bill 235, an act relating to child protection, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and Rule Act number 47, being original House Bill number 235. Have so signed.
House and Rule Act number 48, being original House Bill 241, an act relating to the Wyoming retirement system, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and Rule Act number 48, being original House Bill number 241. Have so signed.
House and Rule Act number 49, being original House Bill number 251, an act relating to trusts, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign and Rule Act number 49, being original House Bill number 251. I have so signed. We are at that order of business of signing of enrolled acts, Senate files. The reading clerk will read the enrolled act.
Senate Enrolled Act number 20, being original Senate File 16, an act relating to state symbols, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 20, being original Senate File number 16. I have so signed.
Senate Enrolled Act number 21, being original Senate File 38, an act relating to the Federal Real ID Act, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 21, being original Senate File number 38. I have so signed.
Senate Enrolled Act number 22, being original Senate File number 59, an act relating to highways, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act number 22, being original Senate File number 59. Have so signed.
Senate Enrolled Act being number 23, being original Senate File 85, an act relating to cooperative electric utilities, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 23, being original Senate File number 85. I have so signed.
Senate Enrolled Act number 24, being original Senate File 130, an act relating to child abuse, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 24, being original Senate File number 130. I have so signed.
Senate Enrolled Act number 25, being original Senate File number 68, an act relating to water development projects, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 25, being original Senate File number 68. I have so signed. Committee announcements, Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet tomorrow, Tuesday, at noon recess in House 18. We'll work on Senate File 145, Engrossed Hospital and Healthcare District Services to Providers, Senate File 118, Engrossed Continuance of Insurance Coverage, and Senate File 80, Engrossed Electrical Installation Exceptions.
Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet Tuesday, February 24th at 8 a.m. to hear Senate File 34, Beginning Agriculture Producer Finance Authority, and also for the committee to begin a discussion on interim topics. Thank you.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Speaker, the Conference Committee on Message 267 concerning Senate File 117, WHIP eligibility, will meet tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock in H-17. The Labor Committee will meet this afternoon upon adjournment in H-17 to work Senate File 24, Healthcare Reform Demonstration Project, and to hear Senate File 93, Oral Health Initiative, Senate File 66, Medicaid Foot Care, and Senate File 39, Child Health Insurance Program.
Chairman Cohey. Excuse me, Chairman Lockhart. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock, H-18, to hear Senate File 44, Pipeline Inspection and Safety, and Senate File 108, Engrossed Long-Term Care Facilities.
Representative Lebno.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee, your conference committee on message number 315 on Senate file number 111 will meet upon adjournment today in Senate 18.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow night, 10 minutes upon adjournment, that's February 24th, in room H-17, to discuss Senate file 119, Engrossed Public Transportation Funding, Senate File 134, Engrossed Embossed License Plates, and Senate File 143, Engrossed Marking Structures That Obstruct Flight.
Chairman Gingrey.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to take up Senate File 88, Required Use of Ignition Interlock Devices, and Senate File 129, Juvenile Justice Amendments.
Representative Throne.
Privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I know all of you have been dying for your edition of the 60th legislature mug they are in, so please see me. Most of you haven't paid. Please make checks out to me since I've already paid for the mugs, and we'll do an extensive auditing process to make sure that I've met all accounting principles. Just kidding. Thank you.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee appropriations number 2 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room 204, and our bills to consider are re-referred Senate File 87, Wolf Brucellosis Testing, Senate File 135, Risk Management, and Senate File 99, Career and Technical Training Grants. Thank you.
Thank you. There will be no meeting of the chairman tonight. We'll do that next Monday. Any other announcements? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move we adjourn until February 24th, 2009 at 10 a.m.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. We are adjourned until Tuesday morning, February 24th at 10 a.m.